Josh and Frankie.
What a couple of dumb shits.
You found Primus Trax, congratulations! We're on Instagram and Twitter at Primus Trax. Primus Trax Pod at gmail.com is the email address. There is a Facebook page called Primus Trax, imagine that, and it is maintained by the number one envelope filter fan in all the land, Frankie Beristein.
Hi, Josh.
Did you want to say a nice special hello to the team envelope filter?
Hi. Oh, yes. Let's keep that hashtag alive, guys. Yell for that envelope filter. If you see Josh, tell him how much you love the envelope filter.
Well, Team Envelope Filter is in effect today. We are talking about Extinction Burst, the final, quote-unquote, final track from Green Naugahyde. There is, of course, an outro track. And we have help in the form of one of our favorite guests. He is the Primus Trax Senior Gearhead. I don't even know if we have a Junior Gearhead, but he's going to be our Senior Gearhead because he's so informative. You can see him dropping some knowledge on our podcast post on Instagram on the handle HamOfTruth86. It's one of our favorites. Matt Hunter, welcome back to Primus Trax.
Hey, guys. Glad to be here.
Hi, Matt.
So excited to have you today. You've got your bass guitar. You have an envelope filter with you.
Oh, yes.
It's. I don't want to make a comment, but it's necessary for this track. We'll say that to start. This is one that I think you had a choice of a few, but you went with Extinction Burst, so... Overall thoughts or initial thoughts on that track going back and listening to it?
Part of the reason I think I was interested in discussing this song is because I think it might be one of the bigger departures on the record. You know, it's I think some of the other guests and yourselves have talked about how Green Naugahyde was maybe, well, and I guess Les said this too, it was maybe a bit of a throwback to kind of earlier days, kind of energy and kind of up-tempo, maybe a little more aggression here and there mixed in, but Extinction Burst just kind of is one of those songs that doesn't kind of sit neatly into familiar territory, and structurally, I think it's a lot more involved than a lot of Primus stuff tends to get, at least in kind of the middle to later period, where you kind of deal more with AB structure or something that's a little more jam oriented. This feels like something that was definitely constructed and put together with a little more sort of compositional complexity. So I find it really interesting from that angle too.
Yeah, it's right up there with Space Farm as far as complexity. I agree.
The three-part prog suite, Space Farm.
Yeah. We've got ourselves quite a track today, as you mentioned. There's a lot to it. We should dive right in. We've got Extinction Burst, 5 minutes and 20 seconds long, track 12 on your Green Naugahyde CD, record, whatever you want to call it. Music by Claypool, Lalonde, and Lane. They're all together. Before we wrap up this record, I did want to note, if you preclude the first track, Prelude to a Crawl, and if you preclude Salmon Men, the final track, which is essentially less goofing around on each of those, if you go down to those 11 tracks that we have in between... Here are your writing credit counts. We've got Les is on 9 of them, Larry's on 7 of them, Jay Lane's on 6 of them. So we have a true team effort coalescing for this record, which I think is really great. I mean, we've pointed out that on past records, it all just says music by Primus, but now we're getting individual credits. It's not just one guy doing everything. They're all working together throughout the record. Sounds great. With that in mind, I'm going to turn it over to Frankie.
All right, Josh. Let's just start with some live history. Extinction Burst was premiered on September 23rd, 2011, at the Orpheum Theater in Boston, and it was played at every full album concert stop throughout 2011, with further performances in 2012 and just a handful of performances in 2013. It was performed for the last time to date at the Danforth Music Hall in Toronto, Canada, on August 6th, 2013. So that's almost a decade without Extinction Burst. The song is one of the most complex from Green Naugahyde, and we're going to go into detail regarding why later tonight. With particular, I think one of the reasons I regard this track as complex is a particularly intricate drum work by Jay Lane. Les Envelope Filter is at the forefront in the track, with Larry complementing perfectly as usual, bursting into a wonderful solo at the song's finale, which we'll also elaborate on. The musical syncopation in the track is remarkable. Now, speaking about, you know, an overview of the lyrics, which we're also going to dive into, psychologically speaking, an extinction burst is defined as the following: both operantly conditioned and classically conditioned behavior. When operant behavior that has been previously reinforced no longer produces reinforcing consequences, the behavior gradually stops occurring. In classical conditioning, when a conditioned stimulus is presented alone so that it no longer predicts the coming of the unconditioned stimulus, conditioned responding gradually stops. Sounds very complicated, right? Many anxiety disorders, such as post-traumatic stress disorder, are believed to reflect, at least in part, a failure to extinguish conditioned fear. Hence, an image of a baby throwing a tantrum was depicted as the visual backdrop during the live performances of this song. I don't know whether the song disappeared from the set list because Les considered that it worked best in the context of the back-to-back performances and not such as in between classic Primus numbers. Or maybe it's because he just forgot about it. Or maybe it's because it's an extremely difficult song to perform. But it would be fascinating to hear what Tim Alexander would do with this song. I think the song is so tough to execute that it was definitely the highlight along with Hennepin Crawler. I mean, Hennepin is my favorite, but in terms of technical value or musical virtuosity, I think Extinction Burst surely was the highlight of the back-to-back album performances. I have to say that I was lucky to catch Extinction Burst at my very first Primus concert in 2013. Wow. I couldn't believe it. I got Extinction Burst out of the album context, and it was glorious.
Good on you, man. 2013 in Eugene, one of these Evening Withs on the 3D tour, they opened up the second set with Extinction Burst. I loved it. I think it confused a lot of people, and that's around the time that some of the people I came with had to leave. I think it was just too much Primus for them. But they were sports to give it a go. What a great way to open the second set. It's so chaotic. I'm a huge fan of this track. And Matt, this is one that I remember from an interview Les did say, Frankie, you were given us some definition of an extinction burst in the psychology context. Les did say he had a friend in that field who dropped that term on him at some point, and Les was really into it, so it made its way into one of his notebooks. I should also add, in one of these interviews around the time of album release, Les used the term fancy footwork. He said, we used a little bit of fancy footwork on that track. So he's
pretty fancy.
It is pretty darn fancy, and he's recognizing that they took that extra effort. And Matt, you talked about the construction of the track. They took that extra effort, but also not just that, they decided to up the difficulty level. It does sound like it would be hard to replicate live. I mean, they were able to do it with Jay. This could be one that maybe Tim's not a big fan of, or they're just avoiding it for a variety of reasons.
Which is unfortunate because it's a really incredible song to witness live, particularly for Dakota, which we're going to discuss later.
But oh, yes.
I mean, in terms of musicianship, it's unparalleled.
You see how active the band has to be while they're playing this tune. Jay Lane especially is working really hard back there behind the kit.
Yes, and it's interesting because we are accustomed to the stop-start quality in Primus's music. I mean, it's not new territory, but the way that they did it on this track, I think is pretty unique because you use the word chaotic to describe Extinction Burst, Josh, and I would say it's like controlled chaos, right?
Oh, yeah.
This is stop-start quality of the song. I mean, it's perfectly syncopated. It's perfectly executed. But every time it comes back, it's like it explodes into this incredible piece of music. I mean, with this soaring guitar solo and a lot of things going on at the same time. And then it's like it stops again, right? It's chaotic, but it's perfectly controlled at the same time. And I think that is something amazing.
I agree, Frankie. The word I would use, since we're all going to use different words for it, it's to me, it's very propulsive. It's like the, even though it has a certain stop-start quality, it's not as if the whole floor drops out at any point, except for maybe before the sort of outro kind of sequence of parts. Mm-hmm. But it's not like Liquid Sky or you know, a song that just kind of everything drops out and gets very sparse. Jay Lane is like constantly just driving and bringing tons of energy, even in the parts where things kind of cut out more on the guitar and the bass side of things where they get more sparse. It's just the rhythm and the energy of the track is just constantly just driving forward.
I'm going to call it epic.
I think you've used that term a time or two before. I do think it does have that quality, though. It's vast in scope in the sense that everything drops out. There's continuity, but it's so staccato. When I put this record on upon release in 2011, this track itself, especially the first minute, brought up inside of me the same level of awe, wonder, and confusion I think I had the first time I heard this band. I'd been a pretty big fan of this band about 20 years at that point, and I put this track on, and all I could think was, what is this? This is incredible. Just so out of left field and all over the place, especially in the first minute, was smiling like a big old idiot.
For me, one of the other reasons this track is so amazing is that after listening to the record in its entirety in order, reaching this track is like listening to everything that is cool about the album condensed into one single song, because you have the operatic style that Les approached for his vocals on this album, combined with his other typical way of singing. You also have this classic stop-start quality of Primus songs, a ton of envelope filter, which is always something good, intricate drumming from Jay Lane that he accustomed our ears to during the entire album, and a combination of Lur filling space to serve the song and delivering an incredible solo. It's like Extinction Burst combines everything they were testing on this record, and it was perfected for this song at the end.
It definitely feels like a closer, I think. Like, or a closer or an opener, I guess I would say. Like, the fact that they opened the second set at the show you were at, Josh,
yeah,
with it, it feels like a track that is clearly has something to say, and it's trying to make an impact. Because, like you said, they seem to have really gone all out for it. So it's a good opener, but I think it's probably an even better closer for the record.
Oh, I think so, too. I think it's perfectly placed. And, you know, we've asked Soya this before. What kind of conversations go on in the studio about this will be the first track, this will be the last track, we want to make a statement here. You know, Soya's talked about, well, you want to end on a high note at the end of side A, start of side B, and so on. So this is obviously the end of side D on your double LP, other than Salmon Men, which is just a little outro. So, yeah, I think they make a pretty big statement here. I want to start with just the first 30 seconds where I had started to have my WTF moment as a young man. Younger man. So much going on. So, Matt, that sounds like some kind of bass looping, right?
I think so.
Yeah, it's just some of that noise that'll loop. But then we get... Sorry, I had to pause it. The dip, dip, mop, mop thing's the funniest thing in the world to me. And it sounds like Jay. I think Jay's doing that. So on one channel, you get your dip, dip, and the other, you get your mop, mop, and he's going back and forth. And then you get a little less falsetto there with that line, today is going to be the greatest day of your life. There's so much goofiness happening here. The following 30 seconds, this is where I remember just staring at my Green Naugahyde liner notes and just going, what the hell am I listening to right now? So I'm just going to play it up to about 1 minute, and then we can try to unpack everything that we're hearing. This comes back around, which I love. He previews it here. Ugh. There's that harmonic. Wow. That's the first minute. Incredible. Love it. So much
it comes,
happening.
Yeah. Comes right out the gate and just kind of smacks you in the face.
I think it's the wildest part of the entire record, and possibly I might get some flack for this, but that might be the wildest minute in Primus history. It's so far gone. You know, they give us everything we're going to hear in the tune, almost everything we're going to hear in the tune, from about 30 seconds to 1 minute on your timeline there. It's nuts. They just give us all this stuff and then they take it away and they give it back to us piece by piece, which is, you know, it's not an uncommon thing to do, but I love hearing it in this track itself.
I mean, I jokingly was talking about prog suites earlier when I was referring to Space Farm, but that's something that's like a trope in a lot of prog rock bands is you have the overture that has like, it gives you a little sampler of like everything that's going to come in the next 25 minutes of 2112 or, you know, scenes, the Dream Theater albums.
Scenes from a memory. Sure.
Scenes from a memory. So like, it's kind of like that where it's nice, concise songwriting in that it gives you a little taste of things that are going to come back around, but it never stops propelling forward either.
Right. And that's common in a lot of classical music suites that will have an overture or an opera or a musical. They'll have an overture. And so you can hear those key phrasings that will come back around at certain emotional inflections, I suppose. And that's the beauty of those overtures. I love that kind of structure. And it's really great that Prague took that on big time. And, you know, it's leaked into non-prog music. You know, I wouldn't call this a prog tune, but it's prog light, maybe. It's getting there.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the more involved tracks compositionally on this record. And, you know, probably, again, as we've talked about mid to later era Primus, where those jammier kind of structures start to enter in, the sort of more composed, more structured material maybe becomes a little less frequent or a little less commonplace than it was on the older records. But this is definitely one of them.
Mm-hmm. And I want to point to one little thing right now before I ask you, you know, about these bass parts in detail, Matt. But I'm going to play just a little bit more of this track. And I've really started to key in on listening to Jay. And I think my favorite part about listening to this record is hearing him switch from the big kick to the little kick. So here's the big. With a head full of pancakes, a gut full of rot, he shoots from the hip for one final extinction. Back to the regular. But he, much like I think it was in Hoenn, he's going between the big and the smaller kick, but he's kind of keeping that same pattern. Doot, 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 doot. He's giving us that extinction burst with the kick pattern on both parts, which is pretty damn cool. Keeping that together so thematically this song's holding together from a rhythm standpoint, I think.
Yeah, and the transition between the two is so seamless. And not only on the record, but having also, I can count myself third amongst us who has gotten this song live.
Nice.
So I saw the full album performed in its entirety. And, you know, Jay Lane live is, if you're a drummer or drummer adjacent, I mean, he's a fascinating person to watch play because nobody plays the way he does. And similarly to how, you know, mesmerizing it can be to watch Tim play something like Over the Electric Grapevine and just make it sound so smooth and effortless, Jay Lane does things all over the kit, most sort of notably on the hi-hat, but really all over the kit, just to such a level of proficiency that he makes it sound easy. But if you tune in at all to what he's doing, there's just so much going on.
That's a great point, Matt. From your perspective as a musician, to my ears, it sounds incredibly complex. But from your perspective, how difficult is this song to perform?
I would say, I mean, certainly on drums. I think it's I'm the least of all the instruments I play. I'm the least good at drums. I'm barely passable at drums. So I'm maybe a little more speak highly and am intimidated by complex drums than I am maybe guitar or bass. But I think Jay is probably doing most of the legwork in this track overall. Lur is doing a lot of accents and supportive work. Mm-hmm. And Les is doing some fancy footwork too, for sure. But I think a lot of it is accented so much by the envelope filter that it takes on a very different flavor than if he wasn't playing the envelope filter. It's sort of like Eyes of the Squirrel is another one I sort of lump in, where the bass line is so, the envelope filter is so integral to the sound of the bass line that without it, it would just not sound right or characteristic of the track.
And yeah, you're right, because the opening riff has like this kind of menacing quality that just wouldn't be the same without the envelope filter, right?
I agree. Yeah, and I'm somewhere between Team Josh and Team Frankie on the envelope filter debate. I usually think it's maybe a little bit overdone, but I think on this track it's hard to imagine it without it, because it's just kind of woven into the fabric of it in such a big way. But it's definitely, I think, to answer your question, Frankie, I think it's the biggest challenge of it is making sure that you remember all the changes structurally of the song, more so than sort of nailing the technical intricacies or the, you know, having the dexterity or what have you. Keeping track of the starts and stops and where it's going next is probably the real challenge.
Another question, Matt, do the drums, particularly the way that Jay hits the cymbals for the stop-start quality of the song throughout the verses. I mean, of course, they are two completely different songs, but just thinking about the way those cymbals sound, does it remind you a little of Cutting Town?
I can see that a little bit. There's a certain kind of trashy quality to the cymbals, and it kind of sounds like, you know, Jay had all sorts of interesting components to his set around this time. Yeah. And there was, I forget the name of the gentleman that you guys mentioned that sort of really outlined in depth, like what all was going on with his kit around this era. So he's hitting like splashes, he's hitting bells, he's hitting something that sounds like a stack, where you basically have two cymbals that kind of sit on top of each other and they kind of rub against each other weird when you hit them. And so he's using all of these little flavors in the in that sparse part where Les is just doing the harmonics and stuff. And there's just so much flair and flourishes and just kind of flavor going on all over the track from Jay.
Yeah, that part in particular with the verses, Jay doing that drum lick, Les giving us the harmonics, and then the vocals with the bullet mic, the verse, and then the following musical chorus with Extinction Burst and the bump, 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 bump. To me, that's, I use the word slinky, slimy, sloppy, flop, sweat, Primus. And they, you know, it takes me back to some of those mid-90s tunes where they kind of had that aesthetic going, that it was looser, but controlled chaos at the same time, to borrow your term, Frankie. And this one, to me, just has that quality to it, and it just feels like a claustrophobic, sweaty, humid mess. I love it, actually. It's even the envelope filter. I know I'm saying this right now. I think the envelope filter belongs 100% in this track. I love it on this track. Absolutely fitting. This Frankie just fell together on the floor. You're right, Frankie.
Yes. No.
And if you don't mind, can you kind of show us what he's doing with the harmonics during that verse and some of the main bass licks that we're hearing here?
Everything you said, it reminded me of the Greasy Granny trope.
Yes.
Claypool always brings that, all these little phrases that he kind of brings out all the time, like fancy footwork. That kind of Greasy Granny, it's dirty, it's aggressive. That's something that's definitely big time in the earlier, you know, to mid-90s kind of Primus stuff. That,
yeah.
It kind of pokes out here and there. Sometimes they're going more into outer space, into the space jams, and that kind of thing. But this is definitely an aggressive track. Mm-hmm. And Jay's energy really kind of brings a different energy to that aggression than more of a thundering kind of stomping kind of Tim beat.
Right.
But it would be fascinating to hear Tim play this for sure. So there's a lot of interesting stuff to unpack on the bass structurally, and I'll sort of briefly also play eventually kind of a little bit of what Lur's doing, just kind of the supportive accents and things like that. But So yeah, I've got an envelope filter on, and I find that for this track and for some, like, not all envelope filter is sort of created equal in terms of, like, Les Claypool doesn't just use one envelope filter sound and then use that for every track that he plays an envelope filter on. Some of the ones on this album seem to benefit from a little bit of, like, a gain stage of some sort of, like, a boost before the envelope filter. It kind of, it makes for kind of a dirtier sound, and it seems to make it a little more reactive in a way that in terms of tonally, I think I got a little closer using that than just sort of going straight into the envelope filter and then into, like, an amp kind of setting. We're starting off on some harmonics, and it's on the D and the G strings at the fourth fret. Kind of going G string, D string, G string on the fourth fret, and then to the seventh fret on the G string. So every note kind of, it comes back to that, you know, fourth fret harmonic on the G string. And that's, what's interesting about that is compared to the riff that it comes into in the verse. Mm-hmm. It's, and I had to look up the term for this because I believe it's an inversion of the notes that are, the harmonics go. So I'm coming back to the prog suite because that is straight up classical, you know, 101 stuff right there in terms of.
Yeah.
And Eddie Van Halen. You know, that kind of stuff. It's just, but it sounds, it's really cool that he goes from doing that in harmonics and then to a bass line that doesn't necessarily mirror what he was playing, but it plays in the notes that would be the inversion of those harmonics.
Ah, okay.
And so for the actual notes on the neck, when we're in the verse, we're up on the ninth fret of the A string. And I play it up here because I did my forensic work and I was looking up all the videos of Les playing it live.
Yeah.
And I, for many, many years, was playing it down here where he does the harmonics, because you can play it right down there exactly sort of where he's playing it on the neck. But he plays it up top. And I think that's because when the verse riff goes up, and it goes up in a diminished interval, of course, all the greatest hits are going to come out today. So we're going diminished. We're going tritone. We're pulling out all the stops because that's what Primus does. But when it goes up and he plays those power chord accents.
Yeah.
You get the full three notes if you're playing up here on the neck, as opposed to just the, or the.
Oh, you're just going to get a fifth down there. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're just getting the fifth as opposed to the full kind of power chord with the octave if you're playing up here. And I think that's why he does it, or it's just an easier stretch because you're further up the neck. I'm not 100% sure. And this flurry of notes goes by so fast, similarly to Eyes of the Squirrel, which I mentioned earlier. So I'm not, you know, 100%, it's not legally binding, but what I believe he's playing is, again, we're at sort of the ninth fret on the A string, and the eighth fret on the D string is sort of where you're going to be anchored. And it always sort of comes back to that.
Okay.
In sort of the middle and the end of the riff, it just keeps coming back to that interval. And the other part of the riff is kind of playing two frets up from it in a very sort of, you know, harmonically pleasing way. So I believe it goes, so those notes again, so, you know, ninth fret on the A, eighth fret on the D, and then we're up at the 11th fret on the D, 10 on the D, and then 11 on the A.
Wow.
And then it kind of hammers on the root all the way back down at the second fret on the E string, and that is an F sharp.
Yeah.
And I'm not great with music theory, but I tried to do my homework today, and I think that is F sharp Lydian.
Oh.
Which I don't know if that's something that is often heard in Primus. I don't think it is.
I don't think so.
It sounds a lot prettier than a lot of Les stuff usually is, but... And then it goes back.
Oh, yeah.
What's interesting is it goes from that into the riff that's played in the intro that kind of foreshadows itself. Yeah. And then suddenly we're in a different key. So it goes to basically being in G sharp from F sharp. And it goes into a minor. Goes into basically a melodic minor scale. And it just kind of playfully kind of descends from that note down to the root that they're doing at that G sharp, and then kind of climbs up.
Yeah.
Just kind of lands back on the root and then descends again back down. Not the root, sorry, to that. The note that's landing on there is a D sharp. And that's a really cool part, because then Lur also kind of echoes it, but he doesn't play it verbatim. He's just kind of playing some of the notes, which I think is more interesting than if he had just like mirrored it verbatim. And then with the melody that's going on top of that with today, you know?
Yeah.
It's a really interesting part. And so I'm going to switch over real quick to what Lur's doing.
You're a versatile man, Matt.
So what's interesting about what Lur's doing is, you know, he's doing what Lur does, and that he's starting out at the root note of what Les is playing. He's playing it up on some higher strings here. The eighth fret on the G string, which is a D sharp. And instead of going, he's weaving in and out of that riff with being one fret off from what Les is playing, just to be extra dissonant. And he's also then playing some tritone, you know, nasty dissonant chords on. So instead of... I thought initially that he was starting on the same note, but I believe he's at a diminished interval from what Les is playing. So he's going...
That sounds right, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing. Whoops. And he's doing these stabs of those diminished fifth tritone kind of...
Yeah.
What it reminded me of him playing it this far up the neck, where usually he's kind of more low on the neck, kind of playing something a little beefier sounding.
Mm-hmm.
There was a period of time, and I apologize, I always bring things back to metal and like various things in metal. Like I always mentioned Black Sabbath with the tritone. There's a period of time in late 90s, early 2000s, what was called metalcore at the time. That kind of dissonance was like, it was the new hip thing that everyone was doing. And so like there was the Dillinger Escape Plan was doing like,
oh sure, yeah,
and that kind of stuff. I mean, Lur was playing those kind of chords long before any of those folks were, but he's playing it a lot higher up on the neck here than I think I typically hear him play. But so diminished interval from what Les is playing, and then kind of one fret off from that other note that he's playing. So very dissonant. Yeah. And then I think he's just kind of accenting what Les is playing down the neck, and then rushing all the way back up the neck to kind of keep playing that riff. And then let me find where that... And that's kind of more what Lur is playing underneath what Les is doing in the today part.
Yeah, that is way more interesting than just playing the unison riff. You're absolutely right, because he's accenting certain notes as opposed to just... And they have this part near the end where they're playing in unison, and that makes that part much more powerful because they don't show it off until that moment, I think, which is really important.
I agree. The ending part is interesting. It's notable for how syncopated it is, because I feel like that's not something that Primus typically does. I feel like rarely are they all sort of playing the same thing, and the drums are even hitting on the exact same, you know, rhythm of what the bass and the guitar is doing. And it's a very stop start at that point. And then it kind of sets off for a great solo and then kind of wraps up doing the same thing. But it really, that really intense syncopation hits hard for like a very final sounding piece of the record.
Yeah, it becomes monolithic when everybody's playing the same thing in the same time, because we know that this is a groove band, and Les is usually grooving, and Larry will do all kinds of crazy things, and Tim will do his Tim thing, or Jay will do his Jay thing. I'll play that part because it is unusual. And freaking satisfying with that slide down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you're absolutely right. They're pulling it all out. They're doing all their standard things with the tritones and diminished, this, that, and the other thing. But then they're doing some things they don't normally do. So it is kind of a kitchen sink tune in a way.
Very much, yeah. Yeah, it goes a lot of different places. It's very involved structurally. Let me switch back over to bass for a moment. I can show you what that last part is kind of.
When you said that everyone is doing the same thing, even Liz is adapting his vocals to the structure of the track. He's doing the same melody.
Right, yeah. During the verses, he's going with the harmonics. That's a great point, Frank. He hadn't pointed that out yet. And then with the extended burst, he's doing that with that muted heavy part with the bass and the guitar, too. So everything is really tight, even though it does sound like a sloppy flop sweat. In a way. It's so strange. It's such a contrast of ideas, but it holds in my head.
Yeah, we go from that G melodic minor kind of descending lick.
Yeah.
And then from there.
First, yep.
And we get our second sort of, or I guess our third part, which I believe is in a different key. So we've gone from F sharp to G sharp to A sharp for the last part.
And oh, sure, because it's just one whole step up, that extinction burst. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And this part is not as sort of melodically. It kind of sticks within the same framework of the notes that was being played in the previous scale, but it's using a different root note.
Mm-hmm.
And again, forgive me, I'm not super enlightened when it comes to music theory, but I looked up what that would be if we're using the A sharp as the root note, but we're using all the same notes as sort of the G sharp melodic minor scale. I believe it's A sharp Locrian. We're using a lot of sort of very blues scale sounding stuff, but then with some interesting kind of stabs in between, since we kind of keep resolving back to that same note and the way it ends.
Yeah.
It's all very sort of sticking in that kind of blues box feel, but the accent notes are doing, and it took me a while to kind of try to suss out what the accent notes were doing. So we're playing that. I'm not sure where Les plays it on the neck. I think it's easier to play it further up the neck again because of just all that, where the accent notes are. So we're playing at the 13th fret on the A string, and we're kind of just bouncing back between 13, 11, and 13.
Yeah.
I'm just. And that's my envelope filter is not liking me for doing that right now. It sounds a little bit better if I play it lower. And he does that like zip up the neck, which is always really, really fun. You can't like not do that if you have the envelope filter on.
A Claypoolian move it is.
It sure is. It always reminds me of the Fancy DVD and Cosmic Highway.
Oh, sure.
The jam in Cosmic Highway, he does like. And he just like really like. Lays it on thick for that one.
Yeah.
It's really funny. But yeah, so the accent notes, we're going to the ninth fret on the G string. All of the accent notes are on the G string if you're playing it here on the neck, which I think is where he's playing it live.
Okay.
So it starts at that ninth fret. Then we're at the eighth fret, sixth fret. 11th fret, 12th fret, and then I think it comes back to the 9th fret.
Yep.
And it's a little easier to play it up top, like I said, because you can, instead of having to jump all the way up every time on the G string, whenever you need to hit one of those high notes, you can kind of hit it on the G. If you're playing up here on the 13th fret on the A string, you can kind of just bounce over to the G string there. It's a lot easier, but doesn't seem to sound as good with the way my envelope filter is set right now. But it, and then the under the solo, Les is just kind of bouncing around on those same notes. He's going from and so it's kind of, again, just kind of staying. It's a very blues box feel, but then he throws in the, which is kind of like that. And I always thought it would sound, I always wonder, like, why does he play it up top? Why doesn't he?
Right. Yeah.
I think with some of the, I don't know, the fancier finger work and footwork that he's doing and the envelope filter, maybe it just kind of pops a little bit more when he plays it on the higher strings.
In that mid range. Yeah. I think it's where most of the envelope filter is really sounding out, is in that mid range. And I think that's probably why he hangs out there quite a bit playing, say, one or two of those parts without the envelope filter. So we can get a taste of it without cause I just have a feeling it'll sound more barren and just not as exciting.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, so I'll just sort of give you an overview of the, and I sort of have, there's that little bit of gain that I have on there that kind of gives the envelope filter a little more flavor. But so I just have like a very clean sort of standard tone. It's just not the same. Yeah, it's weird.
I think it's not too squishy, if that makes sense. The envelope filter's not overbearing in this track. It's providing flavor. And what Les is doing, so thank you for playing it clean like that, because I, comparing that to, you know, the recording I have in my head, having listened to this track 1,000 times and loving it every time, is that that's all coming through, but the envelope filter is providing some flavor as opposed to being the star of the show.
I would agree. I think the only parts where it sort of, it becomes its own thing is in those flurries of notes.
Yeah.
And that's why I mentioned Eyes of the Squirrel too, where it's sort of, it's something like that. I don't know 100% what Les is playing for that, because you can't really hear what the notes are. And when you see him live, his hands are just a flurry. They're flying.
They're blurry. Yeah. So.
And so the character of the it's the bubbliness, you know, the wah, 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 it just kind of takes over. And so in the main riff work, you hear the very clearly, but that part is a little less clear to me, and where I'm not 100% sure what he's doing, but looking at his fingers, that seems to be what's going on. But yeah, for most of the song, you're hearing enough of those individual notes. They're given enough space to breathe where you can clearly hear what note is coming through. And the filter is just adding a sort of, squishiness and a kind of flavor to it.
Yeah. Frankie, this is not me converting to Team Envelope Filter. This is me appreciating it.
All right.
Baby steps. Matt, thank you so much for showing us all those different parts on bass and guitar. I want to turn to the guitar solo, because my goodness, do they lay a foundation for a great guitar solo with everything that has come up to this point at about the 4 minute mark. And then we get this. There it is. You guys know how I feel about a ride cymbal. And then just right back to this. A couple more iterations of this. And they're out. I can respect the hell out of that. They don't overstay their welcome. They just give us some awesome shit and then they get out.
And then it ends with that same kind of that sonic ambience that it came into too. Yeah, full circle.
Full circle.
Overture.
You're right. Yeah, it creates that. It does create a cycle. Yeah, so if you're listening,
I agree.
To that,
it's not proggy, but it's definitely like very. It feels very deliberate in the way that it's composed, for sure.
Yeah, I've used the term prog light a bunch of times, and I think that's where this one lands. A lot of Primus does actually when they really get down to it. You know, I think that's kind of the direction they're going with the latest EP too. So, I mean, the train's already about to derail anyway with the chaos of this tune, and then Lur gives us that really nice solo, and it's a big one. In the sense that we've got this really great groove, we're really up tempo. Jay's nailing that ride cymbal, and he can bring it on home. And Larry really does in the second half of that solo. But I want to toss something out to you, Matt. Space—not the solo itself, but just the space for the solo reveals some of the limitations of Larry's Fender setup at the time. Because I just want—I'm not getting more of a sharp edge on that solo, like with those PRS's, say, Pork Soda Punch Bowl Brown album era.
Yeah, you know, I can't disagree with you there. I think that this tone really lends itself to, I think it really lends itself to certain types of playing and certain types of Lur solos. Mm-hmm. Like when I hear the solo in Lee Van Cleef, for instance, like that's, for me, that is the high watermark of the album for Lur, for me. It's because it harkens back to like that Winona's Big Brown Beaver kind of solo where he's doing some, and I'm not even very familiar with Grateful Dead, but he's doing things that are outside of what he typically is doing to support Les in terms of like that kind of, there's a little bit of country in there. Right. There's a little bit of pluckiness, and there's some runs of notes that he doesn't necessarily deal in. And it's sort of more jagged and percussive and staccato than sort of these like smeary kind of, you know, singing lines like he starts the solo with. So yeah, this type of solo where there is more, the notes are more stretched out and there's more space. I think that the sort of pluckiness and stringiness of the Fender sound doesn't quite fill that space in a way that, you know, humbuckers in a Gibson or a Paul Reed Smith or a slightly gainier, more mid-rangey amp like a Marshall or an Orange or whatever he happens to be using at the time kind of fills in that sonic space a little bit more than his setup in this era. Mm-hmm. So I think that's actually a really good observation.
Yeah. I think if he came through with that PRS sound as a buzzsaw with the sounds he's making, it would be that much more satisfying. Otherwise, great solo. Really, really takes off, especially in the second half. Where are you on these guitar solos? Because I know this is a big track for you on the record. Does the guitar solo hold up for you?
Yes, it is absolutely fantastic. And it works pretty well at the end of the song. We have discussed previously how, for example, with American Life, the coda is the reward, right?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Especially when you listen to the song live. In this case, the solo is extremely rewarding, but the track itself doesn't demand anything out of you in order to reach that point. I mean, it's incredibly enjoyable from start to finish because it's such an interesting piece of music. Again, yeah. I think throughout the verses, Lur is serving the track, and on the solo, he's going all out.
Beautiful words, Frankie.
Yeah, it's. I think you're right, Josh. If it filled a little bit more of that space, it might even feel more like a classic kind of '90s, like mid '90s kind of. I'm thinking like maybe even Pork Soda kind of era or Punch Bowl era kind of Lur solo, but that sort of like how Jay's drums bring a very distinct flavor to this record, even though some of the songwriting might be more energetic or more heavy, kind of in line with some of the older material. I think that tone. The tone of all the instruments, I guess, the bass is certainly very distinct, pretty different, I would say, from Les's classic, you know, older 90s sounds, and the guitar definitely so too. So it does really lend itself a very specific sonic kind of signature But yeah, I can't help but thinking like there's a little bit more mid range and a little bit more gain just help it take off and sing a little bit more.
Right.
But I agree. The second half of the solo really kind of picks up and drives it home. And what was funny listening to that is one of the previous tracks I was on for Renegade, album closer, solo, and it kind of punctuates, you know, like real kind of syncopated. I didn't plan that whatsoever, but like the parallels are all there. And it's, yeah. I just always feel like that's such a great way to end the record. And then you sort of have the epilogue with Arnie or Salmon Men that just kind of gives you some atmosphere to ride out on.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a pattern forming there because if you the last half of Grapevine is less grooving on that fretless six, these great noises over it for a couple of minutes. Yeah. And then bop, bop, it's over.
Yeah.
So you really go out on a high, I think, when your track ends with a Larry Lalonde solo, because there's you know, after a Lur solo, you got to come down from it, and nobody wants to come down from that mountain in Lurland. So why don't you might as well end up top. And I think that's great at the end of the record to do that. Frankie, let's talk lyrics. What do you think?
All right, Josh. To be perfectly honest with you, I lived several years of my life not knowing what this song was about, just taking it for what it was, enjoying it musically, and not really pondering the lyrics that much. To be honest, at the beginning, you know, with this whole thing about Kobayashi eating hot dogs and and what he says in the other parts of the song, I thought it was like just this stream of consciousness hush-posh of, you know, different random things. I kind of had the vague notion that he was giving the listener a piece of important advice with the best day of your life part, but I never really sat down to look at the lyrics until fairly recently, you know, when I did some research about what Extinction Burst meant. Mm-hmm. And like you mentioned, apparently Les was influenced by a friend who told him about this term, and he found it fascinating. But to be perfectly honest with you, even after learning about his inspiration, some of these lyrics still appear difficult for me to connect with the topic.
Yeah.
What do you think about them, Josh?
Yeah, I don't think they all completely fit with the into that box of an extinction burst from how we know it from psychology. And it's one of these first concepts that students learn about in psychology. I learned about this in my high school psych class. It goes back to B.F. Skinner, huge name in operant conditioning. If you've ever heard of the Skinner box with the consequences of action. So the mice, you know, he's got mice in a box. They press a lever and a treat comes out and they get food. So they learn to get the reward by pressing the button. In another Skinner box, they press the button, they get a mild electric shock, and they know to stay away from that button and not touch it because they know the consequence. That's operant conditioning. With that example of the kid having a hissy fit, or as my dad would say, being a pissant, you know, the kid's making a scene, you give them some candy to calm them down, you do that a few more times, and they associate being a pissant with getting candy. So there's a reward for being a jerk or having a tantrum. So once you, as the adult, decide to remove the candy bar, the tantrum behaviors will increase. That's the extinction burst, because you've taken away the reward. Those behaviors will increase before eventually subsiding as the kid, you hope, realizes that the tantrum no longer results in candy. And it can take a while, but that intensifying behavior is the extinction burst. So when I read these lyrics, I see it and I don't. With a head full of pancakes and a gut full of rot, he shoots from the hip for one final extinction burst. I'm interpreting that as somebody with a hangover. That was them relapsing into alcoholism, curing their hangover with a whole lot of pancakes, which is not a bad idea. I've been down that road a time or two, Frankie.
I have a couple of questions, Josh.
Yeah.
It's Randy Johnson, right?
Oh, it's got to be Randy Johnson. Randy's thrown fastballs like man's never known. Yeah. And they're friendly with each other, and Randy's photographed a bunch of Primus concerts in his retirement.
Oh, great. Well, one line in particular is a little confusing for me, mm-hmm. because of the context of the verse.
Well, I'll stop you there, because the printed lyrics are "beef on a pancake to a tree" don't mean shit.
That's even stranger. I mean, that doesn't make sense, right?
It doesn't. First of all, I could say that line over and over again. in the context of this operant conditioning thing, if you're offering that as a reward to a tree, it's not going to change its behavior. And I think that's just an extreme example, maybe. That's where I go with it. Yeah, it doesn't make any damn sense. And that's fine. I think
with a head full of pancakes is one of the coolest opening lyrics to a song that I've ever heard. Because, yeah, I agree. So I have some background in the psychiatric field. And so I've had trouble reconciling what Extinction Burst means with what I'm trying to figure out the lyrics are trying to say or trying to get at. And it's just, there's all these lines that are so bizarre. They almost sound like a Southern idiom that like exists in like Texas or somewhere where it's like, well, it has that kind of a ring to it.
Yeah. Like a cultural idiom. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. But I've never, it's like a compilation of those, and I don't know how they fit together or what they're trying to say. But it's funny because he mentions pancakes twice. So how bad could it be?
Yeah, isn't that strange? I don't get it either. And I, you know, get up on your heels and fight. I don't know. In the face of all the, it's a great line, and it speaks to the towering nature of that part musically that Matt was showing us. You know, in the face of all that you just stay and you'll burn so bright. Don't know what that has to do with an extinction burst, other than maybe the positive reinforcement has been removed and this person is now suffering an extinction burst because it's gone. I mean, that's the only parallel I can draw to it. Everything's great. My behavior's changing. But now the positive reinforcement's gone, so I'm going to have a tantrum or relapse or go back to that behavior that I did before.
The message I've sort of chosen to take from it is that it almost feels like Les took that term and that like phrase and sort of applied his own meaning to it.
Yeah.
In the context of these, he's citing sort of champions of baseball and hot dog eating contests and sort of being like, the extinction burst is almost like the last, it's like that last rush of effort or energy that puts someone over the top to become like the best at something almost.
Yeah.
That seems to be kind of what he's going for with the, today is going to be the greatest day of your life. Get up on your heels and fight kind of part and all that. So that's kind of where I go with it. But then like pancakes, and I'm just okay with it being about pancakes.
That's actually what I was going to ask you about. Today is going to be the greatest day of your life line. Yeah. Because coupled with in the face of all that you disdain, you will burn so bright. It gives the impression that today is going to be the greatest day of your life, but also could be the last, right? I mean, the last thing you'll do with your life will be something glorious or something spectacular.
Yeah, that air of finality to it, right. My hands are in the air. So you guys are asking great questions I can't answer because I'm not the author.
How about some life cuts, Josh?
Yes, please. Okay. We're going right back to the Great American Music Hall, San Francisco, 2012, Frankie. It looks like we're going to get our intro and the first breakdown. I'm pretty darn excited about both those things. I'm no longer Team Envelofilter. Is he up on the neck on this one? He's not in the right position, right? Same position. I think Frankie really likes those cymbal catches there on those accent notes.
Yeah, so Josh, you asked an interesting question there, because I meant to mention this and I forgot. And I feel weird because I feel like I'm always mentioning, like, I don't want to be that person like, you don't play it like you did on the record, you know what I mean? But it's one of those things sometimes Les does over time. Like, I think it was mentioned with Golden Boy. Mm-hmm. I mentioned it with one of the supplementals I did on Blaylene, I think, where there's certain bass lines that kind of evolve and change over time. And where on the record, Les is doing that, on the live, for whatever reason, he seems to do the harmonics at the fifth and the fourth frets. So fifth fret on the D and the G, and then the fourth fret on the G.
Huh.
Which changes sort of the harmonic relationship between that part and the extinction, like verse or chorus or whatever you want. but it just changes the nature of the relationship between those two parts, like melodically, harmonically. So it is different and it feels pretty different. For a long time, I was actually playing it that way because that's how I had seen him play it live. And then I tried playing it to the record one day and I was like, oh, that's different. And so it's it's just one of those things. I don't know if it's because it's less of a stretch. Like they're just, instead of being, you know, a few frets apart, they're just right next to each other. And it sounds kind of sort of close enough, but it is keen ear. It is different. And I think it changes the feel of it somewhat significantly.
It definitely does, because I'm looking for that stretch up to that seventh fret for that higher note, and it's not happening. And it's just jarring because it's so different.
It's really noticeable when you hear them right next to each other like we are.
Yeah.
When I heard it in a live context, it didn't occur to me whatsoever because I was just like caught up in the energy of the, you know, the experience. But yeah, it's interesting.
Let's take a look at the first breakdown. Same show. Ooh, Lur's got a lot of depth there. Love it.
It sounded like there was a little bit more echo, a little bit more delay happening on that one.
Frankie, next, we're on the Guinea Pig Tour. This does not have a date or location, so this must be from your secret vault of wonderful tunes.
Sure, and we know it's not Guinea Pig because they didn't perform the song during that period of time, but I just labeled it Guinea Pig Tour, you know, because it's part of a compilation.
So you're screwing with me.
Yeah.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Well, let's hear the intro to Not Guinea Pig Tour. That one didn't sustain as long.
Josh, did you see what I mean about comparing the cymbals with Cutting Town?
Oh, yeah, I hear it for sure with those cymbal catches, because that just, it's accentuating the heaviness, which is interesting, because you would think you would just pound the shit out of that cymbal, but those cymbal catches make it much more staccato. That descending dun-dun-dun-dun kind of sounds like that. I hear it.
Yeah, and they do kind of have a bit of a trashy quality to them, like I said. Yeah. I think that's the stacks mostly, when he's hitting the stacks, when he's doing the tom rolls and kind of accenting with cymbals here and there.
Yeah.
Those stacks sound especially trashy. I love the sound of that.
That's a great term for it. Let's hear the second breakdown. Opera voice. He's got lungs, man. Les can do it. That was great.
He kind of nailed it there. He went for it.
He hit all those notes, man. He sounded great. Outro syncopation is next. I like this recording. All right. Our last one is Boston Orpheum Theater 2011. Is this the premiere?
It's the premiere for sure.
Mm-hmm. Sounds right around album speed.
Pretty
but
good
also,
for a first attempt, right?
Yeah, and he's playing it the live way as opposed to the studio way. So maybe it was composed like that, and then he changed his mind in the studio.
Did I forget to mention what Liz is doing at the beginning of the track?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, the whole thing's there. The dip, dip, mop, mop, and greatest day of your life.
Isn't it no, no, yep, yep?
Oh, I always heard dip, dip, mop, mop.
Oh, my God, that's crazy. I always heard no, no, yep, yep.
Oh, no, this we're back on the anti-pop track trying to figure out what's going on there with the dog or the swoosh or the whoop or the, oh, my goodness.
I have always heard mop, mop, dip, dip.
Yeah,
myself. Same. Yeah, but I have no idea if that's supposed to mean anything. Or if it's somehow related to pancakes, dip in syrup. Perhaps.
I do like to mop up my pancakes. Yeah,
I'm gonna be at the wall with yarn and pins and just like pancakes and dipping syrup and all sorts of connections here.
This episode's made me hungrier than any other episode ever. All right. Oh, let's hear the guitar solo. Ooh, I like that. Yeah, I like that solo. He's given a better run there on the first half, I think.
Yeah, I especially like the way the solo ends. The way it kind of comes in where it's like, you know, kind of like slides in. It doesn't like announce itself out the gates, but the way it ends with those last several bars where it kind of climbs, it sort of syncopates with the melody that's going on, then it climbs all the way up. It's a very very final sounding, you know, kind of climactic solo.
I think these live cuts exemplify how well the track translated into a live setting. I think they really locked it down.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and going back to something you said right at the top, Frankie, I think that, you know, as far as a reason as to why it hasn't come back, I think my mind goes to tracks that didn't come back for many, many years that I think were also sort of maybe compositionally a little less freeform or jammy or loose, like Welcome to This World or Nut Butter or something, that it took a while for them to come back because they are tracks that you really have to get everybody on the same page for in a big way, because when they stop and when they start, if everyone's not on the same page, it's just going to sound like it's falling apart. And whereas, like, there's a lot of tracks like that on the first couple records, they all played those first couple records, you know, on the road ad nauseum and have ever since. So those are sort of more ingrained than maybe some of the later, more compositionally, you know, involved tracks that have a lot more of those changes and stops and starts to keep track of. So if I had to put my money on something, I think it would be sort of the complexity of it being the main reason that it hasn't made any sort of a return.
For 30 years, they said, we're not a band that rehearses ever. So
I can only imagine how thundering and huge it would sound with Tim playing it.
Oh, I'm in.
Yeah.
Put him on top of a mountain and let him play this one all day. Well, I'll say this. Extinction Burst, you get some positive reinforcement this time because you've been tracked. And that's it for Green Naugahyde. Oh, man. So I do want to thank everybody that helped us with Green Naugahyde. Thank you all so much. Matt, thank you so much for helping us with Extinction Burst. I said More on TV might be my favorite on the record, but it's probably 1 and 1A with Moron and Extinction Burst.
Thank you, Matt. It was a pleasure having you on board, and thank you for playing the song for us.
Absolutely. It's always my pleasure to be on. Thanks for having me back.
You bet. Our next record is Primus and the Chocolate Factory, so get your little outfits on. We're going to have a good time there. Before we get there, we've got some interviews coming your way. We've got some fun, so be ready. Check out the socials at Primus Tracks on Instagram and Twitter especially. That's where you will find our upcoming guests. Later days.
Willie Mays.
Jesus,